So great to see all of you. Great to be back. As I've been telling many of you individually, the trip to Seattle had many dimensions, but chief among them really was visiting the surgeon who did the shoulder replacement 8 weeks ago, and everything is completely on track. Healing is going fine. I'm exactly where I ought to be, which was a little hard for me to trust because all I know is total weakness and pain. And so to get a different perspective from an authoritative voice saying, "You're doing great, just keep going," a huge weight of anxiety got lifted off my shoulders at that point. So I'm coming back feeling not maybe completely sprightly, but feeling okay. I might need a tissue to dot my nose, sorry. So I'd like to talk about all three lessons today, and maybe even throw in a little bit about the psalm as well. And I think the lessons actually hang together in a way that is not always true of lectionary texts, but today they seem to. I'd like to start with Isaiah. Isaiah, what I want to draw our attention to is basically what I think of as a certain prophetic critique of religion, a sensibility having to do with the place of religion, which is one of the geniuses, I think, of the Old Testament tradition, a lesson that we as Christian people, the history of the church, has done battle with over and over again. And it has to do with understanding what it means to be religious. And in the prophetic sensibility, being religious is, in a sense, a means to an end. And the end is the transformation of our personal and social life. So as you read in that litany of Isaiah, he's basically saying this. He's saying, unless your lives change to reflect what you actually do in worship, and unless your lives change so that you are actually doing what you know to be pleasing to me, says God, I hate your religion. I mean, and the language simply can't get really stronger. That religion is an abomination. I despise it. I hate it. I hate your festivals. I hate your prayers. I hate your incense. I hate your sacrifices. I hate it all. Unless you're changing your life. And if you're not changing your life, forget religion, because it doesn't mean anything. And I actually would carry that prophetic sensibility over into our Christian era and say pretty much the same thing. Unless our religion is really transforming us, and that our eyes are opened, and our hearts are opened, and that we're actually doing things to live congruently with what we know here to be true, then what are we doing here? What's the point? What's the point of our religion? And so the emphasis is always on the lives that all of us are living every day. And that's, I think, one of the tensions that is maybe just inherent in religious life, is that religious life, I mean, we're solemn. I'm dressed in robes and vestments. We do things solemnly with ritual. Everything makes it seem as if what we do here is of paramount importance, and in one sense it is. But I don't know if you remember my particular take on what the servant church is. The servant church means that what we do religiously serves all of us in our attempts to live lives guided by God's love. When we get sent out into the world, what we are really trying to do is live our lives guided by a living compassion, a compassion that is alive in our hearts, and that if our eyes and hearts are open, we will see opportunities to put that into practice. That's what we're trying to do. That's what religion is. And, you know, I may be extrapolating too much from a single sentence of Jesus, but you know, he got into trouble endlessly for being not religious enough. which I mean, the irony of that is so delicious. He was in trouble all the time for not being religious enough, and he was challenged on why he was not observing the Sabbath more stringently. And he said, we're not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath is made for us, which I hear as the Sabbath observance is not some obligation that God lays upon us. It's something to help us remember. Remember what it's like to put your business down for an hour or a moment. Remember what that's like, just to let the world be, to behold it, not try to change it, not try to advance your cause or your intentions. Just let the world be. That's Sabbath. We forget that all the time. But so the Sabbath instituted to help us remember it. Then it becomes a religious obligation, and then you're punished if you don't. Nutball stuff. The punishment is forgetting the Sabbath. And you're obsessed and worried about your own business all the time. That's the punishment, not some religious obligation that God is going to punish you for failing to observe. So this, you know, the religion is very practical. You know, it's kind of a school, kind of a hospital. It helps us so that when we get sent out, we might be able to live more in accord with what we espouse. So we go to Hebrews, and I want to talk about that phrase, faith is the assurance of things not seen. And what do we mean by that? And I think a lot of answers get supplied there, of the assurance of things that are not visible to us. And oftentimes it gets, and I would say, reduced to speculations about what happens after death, or doctrines of the church that cannot be verified in any way, so they just are put out there, and things that and you might hear this: faith is the assurance of things not seen. And so even though you can't see it or taste it or even understand it, really, you're supposed to believe it. And I think that's taking things in a significantly wrong direction. What I would put before us today, what is hardest for us to trust in, is the presence of God in the world. The assurance of things not seen. How hard is it for us to believe that the presence of God's love, especially, and if I could speak of it in sort of a single essence, it would be the power of compassion. How hard is it for us to believe that the compassion which originates in God and is in our hearts, compassion is the dominant power of the world? How hard is that for us to believe? How hard is it for us to believe that God's goodness is triumphant? The assurance of things not seen. And it's not that we never see it. We see it fragmentarily, piecemeal, we see in our own lives occasionally. But the general world, the dominant sort of energy of the world, and again, I would put us back to Isaiah, the dominant power of the world seems to be self-interest. Self-interest governs governments, governs corporations, governs individuals. It is, and again, Isaiah and other prophets of the Old Testament are just brilliant in their description of a world guided by self-interest. It's suspicious. It's deceitful. People don't tell the truth. How could you tell the truth? Because what the truth is, I'm going to try to get the better of you, and I'm going to beat you, and I'm going to take what you have so I can get more. And so you can't be naked about that. So you've got to conceal it, and you've got to smile, and you've got to be friendly, and all the while this kind of rapacious energy is at work, dividing people and setting people against each other, the world of self-interest. And what the church has always held up as the contrary to that is the kingdom of God, the reign of God, a social world imagined as energized and guided by compassion, so that there is enough to go around. This world of terrible injustice that the prophets point to so regularly comes to an end. That people live in peace and in prosperity and in plenty, and we are the people that we are ultimately called to be. And it is this, whether it's, and you think of sort of movements that have sort of captured our hearts in the 20th century, the civil rights struggle in our own country, how hard it is, and someone like Martin Luther King espousing over and over and over again the dignity of those they oppose, the dignity of those who stand up for your own rights, the dignity of those who say, you cannot diminish me by your unjust laws because I'm a human being just as you are, and I am going to live in the strength and power of that, not out of hatred for you, out of compassion for you, because we are all diminished when an unjust and false vision of relations between us is enshrined in law and governs our social world. We're all diminished by that, and I'm going to act on the strength and in the confidence that the good will win. That's a very long-term view. As I had a line from a poem of Wendell Berry's came to me the other night, dinner with friends, and Wendell Berry said, you've got to be detached from the immediate fruits of action. It's kind of a, if I knew my Hindu texts, that would be a Hindu text. You have to be, you can't be too attached to the fruits of immediate fruits of action. And he says, plant sequoias. Plant sequoias. I mean, it's a long-term project we're about. And we don't live very long. You know, we're brief little mayflies. So assurance of things not seen. And then we go to the gospel. The gospel begins with a passage that concludes a passage omitted. One of my favorites. It's that long passage that says, consider the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor spin, and yet Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. And if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is today, here today and gone tomorrow, don't you think he will clothe you, O you of little faith? Don't you see that you belong within this great energy of creation, and that as God takes care of the birds of the field, or the birds of the air and the flowers of the field, God will take care of you. Fear not, little flock. It is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. So, consider where your treasure is. And that's also what I want to talk about. Jesus says, consider where your treasure is. Is your treasure here on earth where moth and rust consume and thieves steal? Or is your treasure a heavenly treasure? And in terms of what I've just been talking about, the heavenly treasure is, in a sense, heavenly values, heavenly sensibility, heavenly spirit coming down to earth, opening the eyes so that you get those amazing transformative moments where within the life of an individual, you actually see embodied the kind of compassion that Jesus talked about, the love of enemies. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Or like, as I say endlessly, that Chinese villager who, when asked if he hated the Chinese for destroying their villages, saying of them, of those soldiers, oh no, they're caught in a very bad dream. They're caught in a very bad dream. How compassionate to see someone who is your enemy, who's trying to hurt you, understand that they're caught in a dream of fear. And so the treasure is exactly what I've been trying to talk about. The treasure is the realization of human community, both at the individual level and in our social level, where we actually deal fairly, honestly with each other. And the evil that has plagued us always comes to an end. Be ready, says Jesus, and that's why we sang that Advent hymn, sleepers wake. Be ready. And not, I think, as the early church understood it. The early church, really, if you look at it, they were thinking quite literally of the return of Jesus, a kind of cosmic event, flames in the sky, and even by the end of the New Testament, that was beginning to yield, and they were saying, whatever we thought was happening, take note of this, whatever we thought was happening turns out not to be true, which is, I think, a recurrent human experience. Whatever we thought was happening turns out not to be true, so we have to sort of accustom ourselves to, again, life in history. The Christ is not coming back to end history. And so Jesus says, be ready, and I pass that on to you. Wake up. Be alert. Not for, just that. Wake up and be alert. Because the truth of it is, we don't know what's coming at us in this day. Not one of us knows what this day holds, either in this moment or as time carries us forward towards sunset. We simply don't know what is happening in that time that comes at us. So wake up, be alert, and notice the opportunities you have to be compassionate. It's like the prayer of St. Francis that we say every week at the end of our communion service. Where there is hatred, let us sow love. Well, those moments come if you perceive them. If your mind is somewhere else, if you're worrying about something, if you're daydreaming, you'll miss it. Pay attention, because those moments are the moments that begin to transform our world. Little by little by little, those are the sequoias that we plant in the hopes that our ultimately what we hold to be true will be realized, that God will be all in all, that nations will actually beat their swords into plowshares and occupy themselves constructively rather than aggressively and acquisitively. We long for the end of that, and it comes through us, moment by moment, enacting the compassion that will change the world. Be alert, be awake, because those opportunities come to all.